Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that explores the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Greta Anderson, together with a guest host, Gavin Aronson from the Ames Tribune. Welcome, Gavin.
Hey.
Great to have you here. Gavin's newspaper journalism has caught our production team's attention, and we basically think he's pretty good at what he does. He's been covering local politics and government, which is why we reached out to him for today's show specifically. Today, we've invited both candidates in the Democratic primary for Iowa Senate District 23 for back-to-back interviews at our studio here at 410 Douglas. Senate District 23 covers Ames, Kelly, and parts of rural Story County, including Milford Township to the northeast, Grant Township to the southeast, and Washington Township to the south. In our studio now is Cynthia Uppidale Passion, the challenger in the race. In the second half of the hour, we will speak with Herman Kernbach, who is seeking his fourth term as Iowa Senator for District 23. Welcome to you, Cynthia.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be up early.
That primary date is coming right up.
Holy cow, you're not kidding. It's Tuesday, June 3rd. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. I can't believe it's next week.
Yes, it's been a long journey probably to get here.
No kidding.
And becoming a candidate for public office is a pretty courageous act for anyone, I have to just imagine. How did you decide to enter this race?
I tell you, it was kind of a perfect storm. Sometimes when negative things happen in your life, something positive comes out of it. And for me, it was the month of October was my personal perfect storm. Am I too close? No? Okay. What happened to me in October is I was recovering from surgery. I had my collarbone repaired here in town by Dr. Warmy, who is fabulous. If you ever have a broken bone, go see Dr. Warmy. And then while I was recovering from surgery, I had time to think. And then I came down with a case of the shingles, which is one of the worst things, right? It's painful. You can't really do too much except think, right? So I thought. And then my stepmother died, and I went to her funeral, and I thought, okay, you know, whenever I go to a funeral, I think, okay, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? What did Dawn do with her life that was amazing and incredible? And what do I have left to do? And I thought back to a conversation that I had with Bill Bernow. He's a retired legislator. He's now actually a minister in, I believe, in Jefferson, in Greene County. And Bill, one day, sometime around 1998, I think it was, stopped me on the corner of Ash and Graber Street and said, you know what, Cindy, I'm going to retire from the legislature. Would you like to run? And I said, you're kidding me, right? And he said, no. He said, you'd be great. You know everybody. You know how to door knock. You'd be fabulous. And I said, there's no way. I've got two little kids. There's no way. I can't do it. I can't do it. And so my children are now 25 and 22. So now I can do it.
Okay. So you used to live in Greene County.
No. Bill Bernow lives in Greene County. I have lived most of my life in Ames. My family moved here in 1970. When I was in fifth grade, I went to school at Fellows and Welch and Ames High and Iowa State.
Okay. Well, many people have observed that the Democrats hold on the Senate has been vital in forcing the parties to work together, arrive at responsible compromises given the Republican House and the Republican governor. How do you respond to criticisms that your candidacy threatens this important Democratic stronghold in state government?
I disagree with that very much. I think that any challenge within the Democratic Party, weak or strong, makes the party better. I'm making the party more diverse every day. I'm bringing people to the table who do not like politics. I have friends who have donated money, time, have a yard sign, who have never been involved in politics. Some of them are independents. Some of them are Republicans. Some of them are Green Party. Some of them are apolitical. And they're all getting involved because they feel strongly that it's time for a new face in the Iowa Senate.
So if you were to defeat Senator Kornbach next Tuesday, you would have to then face another former Ames City Councilman, Republican Jeremy Davis, in the general election. Now, have you given much thought to that? Do you have any thoughts about what your strengths are in running against him in the general?
Well,
or is that too far
off? Still? No, it is not too far off, Gavin. Funny story. I went to the Memorial Day celebration at the Ames Municipal Cemetery. Those words are similar. I went to the cemetery after the parade on, what day was that, Monday. This weekend was kind of busy. And I had the opportunity after the ceremony to speak with Jeremy Davis for about an hour. And we got it all figured out. If I win, we've got a plan. We're not going to spend too much money. We're not going to get nasty. We shook hands, and we made a lot of agreements for how we're going to run the race in the fall. So I'm confident that it'll be a good race and a fair race. Jeremy's a great guy, and I'm looking forward to it.
What was one of those details that you agreed on?
One of the details that we agreed on was at the end of the day, both of us are going to go to Des Moines and advocate for term limits. And I asked Mr. Davis if that included the governor's office, and he said absolutely. He feels that Terry Branstad has had enough time to do his work, his agenda, his whatever. It's time for somebody new in the governor's office.
Okay.
And it's time for term limits. It's not a bad idea.
Okay. And in case I was jumping the gun a minute ago, let's go back to your primary challenge against Senator Kornbach. And as a challenger, you're essentially running against an office holder's record, which, of course, he has a quite extensive
long record.
And you are new to running for public office.
I am new to running for public office. I am not new to politics. I started working in politics and advocating on issues when I was 16 years old. I worked for then Congressman Tom Harkin on his first reelection campaign here in town. His family babysitter was my friend Carla, and Carla's dad was the mayor of Ames. And so Carla roped me into Carla Hammer. You remember Mayor Hammer? Anyway, your listeners will remember Mayor Hammer. He was a force of nature. But Carla and I did some phone calls for Tom Harkin in 1976, and that was the first time I worked on a race. In college, I was in charge of Iowa State University students for John B. Anderson when he ran as an independent for president. And the leadership of the Anderson campaign was so impressed with 20-year-old me that they made me an elector. So if Anderson would have taken Iowa, I would have been in the Electoral College, which was really cool. And we did win Story County.
So what part of Senator Kornbach's record in the Senate have you been hearing the most about from your canvassing?
That is a great question, Gavin. I love that question. The issue I have been hearing the most about is continuous improvement. And it's kind of a hard thing to explain when I'm door knocking, but honestly, most people bring it up to me. They say, oh, Kornbach, he's the one who did continuous improvement. I can't stand that. You know? Or sometimes the language gets a little saltier, but there may be young ears listening. The other issue that I have been hearing about...
Let's pursue that continuous improvement. Many people might not know what that
is. Sure, I understand. The way it has been explained to me by people at Iowa State is it is kind of like No Child Left Behind for the Regents institutions. This year, it went into effect in, I believe, July. Okay, so this is the first year that continuous improvement has been a thing. And right now, it only affects sections, not individual classes, but sections say, for example, English 101, okay? You might teach a class of English 101 with 20 students in it, but your section number would be in the hundreds, right? In the thousands, probably, at Iowa State. So all of the professors, all of the instructors of English 101 have to measure student learning over the course of the semester. And they can do that however they want, but they have to report it to the legislature, right? And it's busy work. It's intrusive. It cuts down on student teacher contact time. Nobody likes it.
So this is for all colleges in Iowa?
It's not. It's only for the Regents schools. Oh. And this year, it's only for sections of 300 or more. Next year, 200 or more. The year after, 100 or more. So pretty much every class at Iowa State, every class at University of Iowa, every class at UNI.
Okay. Now you can go ahead and talk about the other issues,
yeah,
I suppose.
The other issue I really want to talk about is e-cigarettes. The legislature passed, and I don't know for sure if the governor has signed this bill yet or not. Maybe you guys know. E-cigarette bill?
I would have to check, but okay.
I think Gavin already checked that.
Indicated his willingness to last
thinking,
week at least. Yeah,
okay. He said he was going to sign the cannabis oil. I heard that.
Mm.
Anyway, e-cigarettes are those fake cigarettes. They're becoming extremely popular with young people. Sometimes they're flavored, like bizarre flavors like watermelon, which sounds disgusting to me, but apparently if you're young and you don't want to smoke tobacco cigarettes or you're not old enough to smoke tobacco cigarettes, that's an attractive thought. Go ahead.
He did sign the bill.
He did sign it.
Yeah.
Oh, well, great. Okay, so the e-cigarette legislation, the senator's spin on it is that it's keeping e-cigarettes out of the hands of young people. This is what he has said repeatedly. Okay? But
can you describe what the legislation is that was
what
signed?
What it is it ostensibly keeps cigarettes out of young people's hands, regulating where they can be sold, how old do you have to be to buy them. The Story County legislation went so far as to regulate the way they were displayed in stores. Were they behind the counter? You know, things like that. But the missing link in the e-cigarette legislation that was passed by the Iowa legislature, the missing part was taxation. E-cigarettes are not taxed like tobacco cigarettes under this legislation. The other missing part has to do with the Iowa Clean Air Act. No longer can you stand in a restaurant in front of the doorway of a hospital and smoke a tobacco cigarette, right? E-cigarettes, you can smoke those wherever you want. So the legislation as it was opposed by Representative Lisa Heddens, Representative Beth Wessel-Crochelle of Ames. It was opposed by the Iowa Department of Public Health. It was opposed by the Lung Association, the Heart Association. Every advocacy group in Iowa that advocates for health opposed this bill. Who was in favor of the bill? Herman Kornbach and the tobacco industry.
Okay, so the opponents of the bill felt that it did not go far enough to discourage young people from smoking.
It was a crappy bill. It was just a lousy bill. And the sad thing is, I asked a woman who serves in the House right now, can we pass something better next year on e-cigarettes? She said, probably not. Because the tobacco industry and the retail industry in Iowa is a powerful lobbying force.
The thing that's just as interesting as the actual e-cigarette legislation, which I've covered quite a bit.
Yes, you have.
Yeah, maybe to a fault. I don't know. I'm not sure how that came to be, but
it should be covered. It's crappy. Anyway,
well,
go ahead.
I'm not going to take a stance on it, but
of course you're not.
You've kind of positioned yourself as in the context of this split between local representatives, and I know you've spoken before about how you would be interested in aligning yourself with Representative Heddens and Wessel Crochelle.
Right.
Is there anything you can elaborate on as far as that is concerned?
I can elaborate. I cannot speak for either of the representatives, but they are friends of mine. They cannot take a position in this race because I am running against an incumbent that they have to work with next year if I lose. One person I can say that I've been working with is retired Senator Johnny Hammond. She's been very helpful to me. And I would take a lot of tips from her as far as how to advocate on human services issues. That was her area of expertise. She was a social worker. She did a lot of stuff with food stamps, with WIC, with a lot of good programs that help people.
Okay.
Well, that brings me to a question as far as your areas of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell our audience a little bit about who you are and, for instance, what committee you'd like to, be interested in joining? What would you bring to the Senate?
Absolutely. My background is in journalism. I did 4 years at Iowa State, well, four and a half, truth be told. And I wrote for the Iowa State Daily the whole time. I worked at the Waterloo Courier, the Clinton Herald, and the Ames Tribune. So I have a background in print journalism. I write. I can condense things into short sentences. That's what I learned in journalism school. I can interview people. And my main experience interviewing people, besides the print experience, would be my last 16 years I've volunteered my time with hospice. And what I do is I go into people's homes who have been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and I interview them. And they tell me their stories. And it's been the best job I've ever had. So I am somewhat of an expert on end-of-life care, health care, senior issues. I'm becoming more of an expert on veterans affairs because many of my hospice clients are veterans and they have specific concerns.
I've heard that you want to restore civility to politics.
Absolutely.
And is that an issue in state government? Obviously,
we see... It's a huge issue. It's a huge issue. every day, I'd open up the Register during the legislative session, and I'd read, so-and-so threw a punch at so-and-so, and so-and-so called another guy a dirty name, and it makes me sick. You know, it's like, why do this if you're going to be a jerk? Your job is to represent the people of Iowa, right? You're not there to pick fights and to do partisan bullying. You're there to serve. You need to serve.
And I'm sure you're aware of the little controversy, I guess, that Senator Kornbach got himself in the other year with in terms of the discussion with a female colleague. And I assume that is something you're hinting at when you talk about civility in the context of the primary.
I'm hinting at it, Gavin, because that was embarrassing to me. And I met Senator Sinclair at a conference I was at in January, and she spoke to me about that incident and how that motivated her to come to Ames and campaign for Jeremy Davis, which she has done several times, I think. And the Republicans have that YouTube video ready to play at the drop of a hat. And one of the things that I talked about with Jeremy Davis was that video. And he said, Senator Sinclair has been here campaigning for me. And he said, if you win, I can't play that video anymore.
Can you describe the video for our listeners?
Oh, geez. Okay. If you go to YouTube and search for Kornbach Sinclair, you'll find it. Senator Sinclair offered an amendment to oh, criminy, I don't even know what bill it was, but she offered an amendment that I think she had not written herself. Okay, so Senator Kornbach took it upon himself to correct and question Senator Sinclair, who was a freshman senator, right? She was new. So he asked her to define several terms related to research or economics. I'm not even sure what the terms had to do with the bill, but he grilled her, and she, to her credit, stood up there and defined the terms the best that she could. But at the end of the discussion, he stood up in front of everyone in the Senate and said, Senator, you're 0-for-3. And I thought he was completely out of line.
Okay.
Let's shift focus away from
criticizing
Senator
Thank
Kornbach.
You. Thank you very much, Gavin.
But let's maybe turn to some things that people have maybe asked you about in terms of the question of whether you're prepared to hold public office. You've mm-hmm. spoken about there being a large learning curve that you will have to sort of just experience once you get into the state Senate. But how would you respond to criticism that you may not be well-versed enough on the issues at this point?
I have heard that, Gavin. I think it's kind of like saying to a woman who's pregnant, oh my gosh, are you really ready to have a child? And nobody's ready to have a child. You ask for help. That's the only way you can raise children, right? And I've raised children. I've been married to the same person for 32 years. I am very much a part of the Ames community. I know how to ask for help. And that's one thing that I am learning sort of the hard way, and Madeline Russell can tell you that. My tendency, as you know, most of us, is to want to do things myself. You know, okay, I'll go put up the yard signs. I'll go write the speech. I'll do this. I'll do that. And you have to get to a point where you say, there's probably somebody who can help me do this. And it probably will be a better effort than if I had done it all by myself. And I think that's very true of the work in the House and the Senate in Des Moines. If you do it by yourself, it's not going to be as good as if you ask for help. And I can ask for help.
Okay. How would you characterize, I'm sure you've been closely watching the politics unfold, the session that has just concluded. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the accomplishments of the Democrats in the Senate this year?
I think they ran the session mindful of the fact that it was an election year for half of the senators and for all of the representatives. They were looking to the election, and that's an unfortunate outcome. I think, honestly, they get more done in the off years than they do in the even-numbered years when half of them are up for election at least. You know, it's hard when you have such a slight majority in the Senate and you're in the minority in the House and the governor's a Republican. It's hard to get a lot done. But we have to talk to each other. We have to talk to each other about things that we don't want to talk about. We have to talk to each other about guns. You know, we just had another mass shooting, right? Do we have sensible gun laws in Iowa? I don't think so.
Have you been enjoying the reporting in the Des Moines Register about which state lawmakers have brought guns into the Capitol?
Oh, my God. It scares the crap out of me. Do I want to show up for work with somebody with a gun in their jacket? A gun in their purse? No. I went through a metal detector when I went to the Capitol this year.
Mm-hmm.
So did Madeline. And I don't know why the lawmakers don't go through the metal detector. Why do they get to walk past it? Do you guys know?
I don't have any expertise.
Apparently,
they just
walk by, right?
Beats me.
That's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, can you just elaborate on your observation that it was an election year and that the legislators were, I don't know, pandering to voters as opposed to getting things done?
Absolutely.
Or you can talk about how they got things done in the past, perhaps. And
absolutely. I think when you've been in office as long as Senator Kornbach, you start thinking about who's going to give me money this year. And that's just, that's normal. That's normal. If you look, and this is available for anybody to look at, if you look at the campaign and ethics reports for January through May, you will notice that I raised three times as much money as the senator. I raised $21,000. He raised seven. My gifts were from my 4-H leader, people I've known most of my life, people I went to college with. Those were individual gifts, and if you look at Senator Kornbach's gifts, a lot of them are from lobbyists. A lot of them are from PACs. I don't have any PAC money. I don't have any lobbyist money. I just have, you know, my Christmas card list.
Now he'll respond to that, of course, by pointing out the campaign filing report prior to that, where he did have
he had an event at the Octagon in December,
and there are quite a few Ames residents on that list.
I know,
but also he has some endorsements.
He invited me to that party.
Okay, I guess we're running close on time, but I should mention, you know, that he is, you know, was endorsed by Senator Harkin yesterday. I believe, and so he's got kind of the party backing, and how does that play into your thinking in terms of your challenge?
Honestly, I don't think Senator Harkin had a lot of choice there. He's worked with Herman over the years. You know, like you said, he's an incumbent, so it's logical.
Well, we are drawing near to the end of our time with you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Is there any last message you'd like to give to the voter?
You know, this this whole process has been really, really interesting. I have gotten more unsolicited advice from total strangers than I ever have in my entire life. And I really, really appreciate how engaged people are to the point that they're giving me hairstyle tips. You know, it's funny, but it's also really exciting, and I am having a great time. This was a great decision to run, and win or lose, I hope people show up at the polls and take part.
Well, thanks. You've given us material for a local talk show, so
all right.
Thank you for that.
All right. This was awesome. Thank you for inviting me.
Anderson back with you, along with guest host Gavin Aronson of the Ames Tribune, who covers local politics and government. We just heard the song Election Day by Blaze Foley, and we are here reminding you that Election Day, that is primary Election Day, is right around the corner, this coming Tuesday, June 3rd. On the Democratic side, the only contested race is for Senate District 23, covering Ames, Kelly, and some parts of rural Story County. We just spoke with challenger Cynthia Passion, and now we have Herman Kurmbach in our studio, who just finished his third term in office and is seeking re-election for a fourth. Welcome, Herman.
Thank you for having me.
We will ask you to defend your criticisms that we just heard in a moment, defend your record against these criticisms. But first, why don't you share what you feel are some of your accomplishments in the last couple of years?
Well, we've done a number of things. Most importantly for me in the education area, I'm the chair of the Education Committee, and I'm also on the Education Appropriations Subcommittee. So I'm in a real good position to help the university and to help education at all levels. I think that the top of the line accomplishment this year is to provide the additional funding that the Regents universities need in order to allow a second year of a tuition freeze. This is for in-state undergraduates. I know that next fall I'm going to have about 220-something undergraduates in my Econ 101 class, and I'm sure they're going to be very happy about that, and I know their parents are pretty happy about that as well. In the last three years, we have passed two major education reform bills in 2012 and 2013 on a bipartisan basis. The governor made significant reform proposals. I know you're going to be shocked to find that I didn't vote for this governor, but if someone wants to have a conversation about improving education, I'm going to be at that table. And so we took the proposals that he made, we reviewed them line by line, said, okay, this part we'll keep, this part we need to fix, this part needs to go. We added a few ideas of our own. In the end, we wound up with two significant bipartisan education reform bills. In 2012, the main focus on early grade reading. In 2013, the main focus on teacher professional development. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I'm supportive of every last measure that's in those bills. I mean, that's the nature of compromise and divided government. But we did manage to work together. I think they were great bills for public education, and I'm very proud of that. As education chair, I was very much involved in formulating both of those bills. And so we have a record of not only getting good things done for education, but being able to work in a bipartisan fashion to do that. Something else that I would point to from a year ago was the expansion of Medicaid. This is related to the Affordable Care Act. There are a lot of states that have rejected an expansion of Medicaid, really inexplicably as far as I'm concerned. At the beginning of the session, the governor said no way that this is going to happen, but we kept after it and kept after it and kept after it and worked with the health community, with the hospitals, with the medical society, all of these people. And finally, we got the governor and the Republicans to come around. We had to make a few compromises. The governor wanted some things in there about wellness. Well, that's fine with me. I'm all in favor of wellness. So we got something done. It wasn't exactly the federal model. We had to get a special approval from the federal government, but we got that. And as a result, we've added, I think, 50 or 60,000 people to medical coverage through that program. So I think that that's another major accomplishment. We've had a record of being able to work together with our counterparts. Now, I'm not telling you we wouldn't get a lot more done if we had a Democratic House and a Democratic governor, and I'm hopeful for this fall along those lines. But I think that we have a real positive record of accomplishment.
Okay. Let's talk about that 2013 education bill that mm-hmm. has been described as continuous improvement. Is this the one that you're referring to?
No. There was an element in the 2012 bill. That policy, though, goes back, was actually established by the Board of Regents in 2004 as part of their strategic plan. And I'm supportive of that because I think that we owe our students the best education we possibly can provide.
Okay.
Now, of course, your primary opponent, that's one of the things that she is opposing you on, the continuous improvement, and she compares it to No Child Left Behind.
I think that comparison is quite inappropriate.
Why is that?
Well, it really has nothing to do with No Child Left Behind. Again, the policy was established by the Board of Regents. The idea is that you define goals for your classes, for your students to achieve, what you want them to know, what you want them to be able to do. You measure whether they accomplish those goals, and then you use that information to cycle back into improving the coursework, the course design, the course materials, all of the elements that contribute to student learning. Like I say, I think that we owe our students the best possible education that we can provide. And I can tell you that in my department, you know, I teach Econ 101 every fall. It's one of the largest courses in the university. This has led to more collaboration amongst the Econ 101 instructors than at any time in my 25 years at Iowa State.
So the difference between No Child Left Behind and this bill might be the standardized, the degree to which the tests
well,
the, accomplishments
no
are standard.
No Child Left Behind is about beating up on schools and beating up on teachers, and that's not at all what this is about.
Okay.
Now, can we go to this universal preschool bill, which I know that you know, Cynthia Passion is broadly supportive of, and that it passed the Senate. There was disagreement in the House about funding, and I know we've spoken about this before in terms of your opinion on how much leeway, you know, the kind of the Republicans are willing to give in terms of this kind of ongoing process of bipartisan.
Sure. Well, let's go back and review where we're coming from. 7 years ago, I participated in establishing the statewide voluntary preschool program. That's a program for four-year-old kids. It has grown over time. Now 90% of the school districts offer that program. There are 10% of the school districts that still don't offer that program. And even the ones that do offer don't necessarily offer enough seats to meet all of the demand. Ames does. Ames has a great record. The program is located up at the Northwood School, and I visited that a number of times. I think they do great work with those kids. But the preschool experience has been shown through a lot of different research, some of which have been done by Nobel Prize-winning economist James Heckman of the University of Chicago, but only our own Charlie Bruner, who is a Senate predecessor of mine. He's with the Child and Family Policy Center. They have looked at third grade reading proficiency and compared those groups of students who had been through preschool with those who had not, and the difference is clear. So we really want to get more kids involved in preschool. We especially want to reach out more to kids from low-income backgrounds and kids from racial minorities. They tend to be less likely to be proficient in third grade reading. All right, so they have greater needs. They also, from Charlie's data, are shown to have gains that are at least as big as the general population. I mean, everybody gains from preschool, but kids from those backgrounds gain more. That's the good news. The bad news is that kids from those backgrounds are less likely to participate. So the kids who need it the most and who can gain the most are the ones who are least likely to participate. We need to do more outreach to build that program, to build the enrollment. I did a bill this last year in the Senate that had the goal of 85% participation. Now, we're not aiming for 100%. Some families will keep their kids at home another year. That's fine. Some families will send their kids to private preschool, that's fine. But I think that we should get every kid possible in there. Now, the bill passed the Senate. It went over to the House. The House refused to take it up. I think mainly because it had some money attached to it. We were proposing to create a financial incentive for districts to expand their enrollment above the baseline of the average of the last 3 years. But we did in the end, so that bill in that form didn't move forward. But in one of the final funding bills that went through, we got some language in there to allow school districts to have more flexibility as to how they use the funds. One of the main obstacles we kept hearing about again and again from parents and school administrators was transportation. The preschool program is a half-a-day program. well, what do the kids do in the other half day, and how do they get there, especially if they have working parents? So we loosened up the language there to make it clear that part of that money could be used for transportation of students. So we made some progress there in reducing the barriers. I'd like to go back at that and get some money behind it. And I'm optimistic, like I say, especially if we can manage to get ourselves a Democratic House. Of course, we have to maintain the Democratic majority in the Senate.
Okay. We have heard you called abrasive and even condescending to your female colleagues in the Senate. And in particular, you asked a Republican senator, a woman, if she knew what she was talking about when she sponsored an amendment for, I believe it was, multivariate analysis of longitudinal data. Not sure if that was correct, but what was that about anyway?
Well, the bill that we were talking about was the Education Reform Bill in 2013. And in my opening remarks on that bill, I had singled out that very same senator for recognition and praise for some comments that she made along the way in the committee and subcommittee work that I had thought were particularly appropriate and that led to a major section of the bill. Unfortunately, she later then, later on in the discussion of the bill, the floor discussion, she offered an amendment that would have radically changed how public school teachers are evaluated each year. I think before you put the jobs of 34,000 public school teachers at risk, you owe people an explanation of exactly what it is that the amendment contains. Well, as Ms. Passion indicated, the senator had not written her own amendment. Indeed, it turned out she hadn't really done her homework and couldn't even define some of the technical terms in the bill. So that was pretty embarrassing for her. I said to her later that same evening that I regretted the embarrassment that that had caused her. She said that she was okay about that. And in fact, we have worked together since that time, I think, fairly productively. I mean, we don't agree on a whole lot. Her views are pretty opposite to mine. I mean, she voted against the tuition freeze, for example. But this year, when we were approached by a group of mothers who are concerned about their kids having problems with dyslexia, we worked together to formulate a bill. That Senator Sinclair and I were on the subcommittee that formulated that bill. And the bill eventually passed and indeed has been signed into law by the governor. So, you know, where we can find common ground, I work together. Where we can't find common ground, well, you know, then we're going to have to agree to disagree.
Cynthia Passion mentioned earlier here this morning that she had spoken with Senator Sinclair, with Jeremy Davis, who, of course, would be your general election opponent should mm-hmm. you win on Tuesday. She said that he had told her that Senator Sinclair had been to Ames campaigning him with
well,
him on this issue. Do you perceive that to be any sort of an issue?
I have gone to other districts to campaign for other senators.
Sure.
I mean, the last election cycle, for example, Shelley Stotts, a teacher from Boone, who I thought was a real fine candidate, was running against Senator Jerry Bain, who, by the way, I like, but, you know, I disagree with him a lot. Well, I did a lot of campaigning for Shelley Stotts. She was running. The district lines had been redrawn. Madrid, which used to be in my district, was in her district, so I was down there campaigning for her and introducing her to my friends. I was also up campaigning for Senator Mary Jo Wilhelm up in North Central Iowa. She's a great friend of mine. She is the chair of the local government committee on which I have served all the time that I've been in the Senate. She won her race by 122 votes, and so I'm very glad that I was up there to help her out. I've campaigned for quite a number of other candidates in other districts. That's very common for the people who are in an off-year cycle, right? I mean, only half the Senate is up for election every time. And people have come to my district to help me out. The day I announced my campaign, Senate President Pam Yoakum from Dubuque announced her endorsement of me. So we have a good teamwork spirit in our caucus, and it's quite frequent that people go to other districts to campaign for Senate candidates.
Now, going back to Jeremy Davis, what thought have you given to running a race between two former Ames City Councilmen?
Well, I'm focused on the primary election right now.
Okay.
Well, you did mention that you regretted your language with the...
No, I regretted the embarrassment that she had suffered. Like I say, I don't think that was typical of her. Normally, she's very intelligent, very well prepared. And personally, I like her. I mean, we just disagree on a lot of things. Like I say, she voted against the tuition freeze. So we have some differences on principle.
Okay. Well, I was just seeking to make a transition to the question. If you had a vote or perhaps a proposed amendment that in the last couple years that you could do over and change your position, knowing what you know now, is there any vote that you would maybe like, or any act in the Senate that you've taken that you would like to revise if you could?
I'd have to think long and hard about that. There probably are some issues where, you know, I tried one approach and it didn't work. And so, you know, in retrospect, would I have tried a different approach? Yeah, I probably would have tried a different approach. If you know something is going to fail going into it, you're not going to go there. But, of course, you don't know that in advance.
I guess I'm thinking in particular of the HIV bill, where you came out against or added an amendment that angered some people and who felt that it was counterproductive to the overall goal of the bill?
Well, I voted for the bill in committee last year. I voted for the bill in committee and on the floor this year. It passed unanimously this year, and I count it as one of our great successes. So, you know, in the course of discussion and perfecting a bill, a variety of different concerns are raised. My concern is about promoting honest communication between sexual partners, especially if one is infected with HIV or hepatitis C or any of the other diseases that are covered by that bill. And we found a way to appropriately accommodate those views. And in the end, because we had continued to work on that bill and improve it, this year it got unanimous bipartisan support. Had it gone forward last year, and I was publicly committed to voting for the bill with or without my amendment, that had it gone forward a year ago, it would have done so on a party line basis. If it passes the Senate on a party line basis, it's dead on arrival in the House. This year's bill was much improved. It passed the Senate unanimously. Everybody voted for it. That gave it great momentum when it got over to the House, and eventually it passed the House unanimously as well. So, you know, the legislative process goes through some twists and turns, but eventually I think we got a terrific result, and I'm very proud of that.
Now, I'm interested in shifting focus here. I hope I'm not outlined saying this. Greta and I were both in Story County yesterday at the Board of Supervisors meeting in different roles. I, of course, was covering it for the Tribune.
We were all three of us there in different roles,
and yes.
Yes,
and that's, of course, where I was going with that. You were, I believe, the only lawmaker who was invited who attended that, unless I'm mistaken. But
I didn't see anyone else there from the legislature. That's correct.
Now, what was your takeaway from that meeting? You were there for almost the entire thing, and that was 3.5-4 hours long, so that was quite a long haul.
Describe to the audience, this was a hearing at the Story County Board of Supervisors concerning a hog confinement, rather large hog confinement going into Milford Township, which is one of Herman's covered areas. So.
Yeah, Milford Township is new to my district. It was added after the recent redistricting in 2010. And in fact, last fall, Milford and Grant Townships had both been added. I went out and I knocked on the door of every farmhouse in my district just to introduce myself. And frankly, it was quite a lot of fun. And people told me over and over again, you're the first office holder or candidate who's ever been out to visit us. So you know, my job is to represent everybody. You know, Ames is my hometown, but I have Kelly, I have Washington Township, Milford, Grant as well. I was contacted by some people in Milford Township who live near the proposed site, and they expressed a concern. I had tried to advise them of how the process worked. You know, it begins with a review by the County Board of Supervisors of the application and a scoring according to this master matrix concept. So I advised them to address that and to address the issues there. And many people did show up and spoke against it, as you did, and I thought you did a great job. There are people who had spoken in favor as well. There's a young couple who's proposing to build this facility. They seem to be very fine people, and you know, everybody there had a great deal of sympathy for them. They're trying to get into agriculture, and this is a way that they can see to do that. Unfortunately, the corporate entity that's lying behind this, Mashoff, I believe is their name, they would not be the owner of the facility, but basically they would own all the hogs and they dictate all the procedures there. They have been cited elsewhere for manure spills and other types of violations. So it does not bode well here for, well, let's just say it raises a lot of legitimate concerns. Frankly, you know, I have long believed that county boards of supervisors ought to have more say in citing decisions than they do under the current law. And, you know, that was a frustration that Supervisor Wayne Clinton expressed yesterday, and I share that with him.
What can be done at the state level in terms of, because here the issue is particularly with clean water and the proposed site's proximity to Indian Creek, mm-hmm. North Nevada. So in terms of on the state level, you know, if the DNR, as Wayne Clinton, for instance, suggested, you know, could be funded more, or if more authority could be placed, you know, on the local level, what would the process be like in the state house to kind of begin that ball rolling?
Well, you'd have to come up with a different concept of how these things would get approved. One of the other criticisms that was made yesterday was that the DNR, which it currently has the ultimate authority, they don't have enough personnel mm-hmm. to go out and to do the appropriate inspection. So one of the things that we need to do is to better fund the DNR so that they can carry out their legal responsibilities. What an alternative regulatory structure would look like, we would have to sit down with county supervisors and DNR and industry people to try to work that out. It's just that I don't feel that the current system is working very well for local communities. There are some aspects that the state should be involved in, you know, the technical standards like construction standards. But as far as knowing literally the lay of the land, the drainage patterns, the watershed, the prevailing wind patterns, those are all very local issues, and the supervisors are the ones who would know them best. I think that they need to have more authority.
Okay.
Will you be talking with any of your colleagues about what you saw and witnessed yesterday or in general about this issue?
Well, assuming that I get back to the legislature next spring, yes.
And looks like we're close on time here again, but I don't want to forget to mention, because we asked Cynthia about this, but your endorsement here from Senator Harkin. And if you have any thoughts on that or any other messages you would be interested in conveying to Ames voters ahead of the primary?
Well, sure. I'm very pleased and honored and thrilled that U.S. Senator Tom Harkin has endorsed my reelection campaign. Tom has been a hero of mine. I think he's been an inspiration to Democrats in Iowa and across the country for decades. His work on behalf of women's rights and disability rights, his work on behalf of education, on behalf of working families, it is a stellar record. And to have such a terrific public servant endorse my campaign is truly a great honor. I couldn't be more pleased.
Okay. Well, Herman Kurmbach, thank you for coming into our studio this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck in the campaign. Good luck to Cynthia Passion as well. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been talking politics with the two primary candidates for the Democratic ticket for Iowa Senate District 23, covering Ames, Kelly, and parts of rural Story County. A reminder that primary date is June 3rd. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, and we've had a guest host, Gavin Aronson, local print journalist with the Ames Tribune. Gavin, thank you so much for sharing this time with me. You've definitely added quality to our presentation today.
Thanks for the invitation.
And what do you think of radio?
Well, I've been on radio before, but never as a host, so it was a new experience, and happy to have had the opportunity.
Okay. Today's engineer for the show was Becca Brown. Local Talk's theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. This show airs 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Tell your friends to catch it here on KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM. Links to the audio and to the candidates' websites will be available later in the day, thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, at khoifm.org. And if staying abreast of local politics is your thing, be sure to tune in to Friday's Local Talk, when KHOI reporter Susan Franzen speaks with the Republican primary candidates for county attorney. As always, your role as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.